This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Like many of us, Hanna Pikova grew up during the Cold War. Unlike most of us, Hanna was raised under communist rule. Her father's anti-government leanings in Czechoslovakia put her family in jeopardy. So at age 18, with only the clothes on her back, Hanna and her parents fled to the West. Hanna's been here for 35 years, but she still has strong ties to her native Czech culture. Today, she teaches Slavic studies at UNC Chapel Hill, and Hanna Pikova is my guest today on The State of Things. Welcome. So good to have you here.
Well, thank you, Frank.
You've been here for 35 years, as we say, in the United States for 35 years,
yes.
Right? Tell us a little bit about growing up in Czechoslovakia.
Well, I was born in the 60s in Czechoslovakia, in Prague. And the 60s were happier years in that country. And they were a little bit freer, a little bit more democratic. It was not a democratic country, by no means. It was a communist country. But nonetheless, they were happier years, a little bit more relaxed. And during these years, I think for my family, these were very important years in terms of professional growth and understanding a bit about what is outside of the borders of Czechoslovakia. My father was able to travel a bit, and we did travel as a family to the United States in 1969. And my father worked in Madison, Wisconsin as a postdoc. So we were able to experience life outside the country. And that had a profound influence on all of us because we were able to see what's out there and how the world is quite different when you move out of a communist country. But we returned and resumed living there, and in the 70s, of course, when I was growing up there as a teenager, the situation was much different than in the 60s. It tightened up quite a bit politically and culturally, and those were what was called the normalization years. And very severe restrictions were put in place again. And, of course, the country was occupied by Soviet troops in 1968 in August. On 21st of August in 68, the country was occupied, invaded, and the troops stayed until 1989.
And as you said, you were in the United States then a year later in 69. So the Czechs had learned the limits of their freedom, of this expansion of freedoms that had grown somewhat, as you said, in the 60s. And everything changed. Your view of the world changed for you and your family. What did it do for your father? Did he become more active, more outspoken politically? Or
I think not really. He was no dissident. He was not trying to be politically active. All he really wanted to do was his profession, his geology. And geologists really don't have any borders. You have to follow the structure of the mountains, the rocks. There are no borders for these people. And like many professionals who actually were able to work abroad in the 60s from Czechoslovakia, he experienced that you do research on a totally different level, that you have access to information. And so you become naturally more open and more willing to share information, and you become more curious. And I think that became a problem for him professionally, but also you see how the regime really suppresses you on daily, your daily life is suppressed, how your freedom is much smaller than you ever thought it was because you have something to compare it to.
And what about you? Were you feeling this?
Well, when I was in America, I was in second grade. I really didn't feel it personally as much because I didn't quite understand the difference, the political difference. But what I did see was that my parents were quite unhappy when we returned. And also, I was told never to talk about anything. And so we had this dual life, right? One on the outside and one within the family, and whatever was said at the dinner table, you could not say outside. So that was secret.
Your family went to Kuwait at one point, right?
Yeah. So in the 70s, early in the 70s, a lot of Czechs, and again, geologists, mathematicians, and doctors were sent to Kuwait. At that time, the Kuwaitis opened up their university in Kuwait City. And they were looking for people, especially from Eastern Europe at that time. They wanted educated people who would teach at the university or work in the hospitals. And the Czech government, although the country did not want its people to leave the country and have the exposure to the West, Middle East was different. And we were very well paid. The government would take the money, too. We had to give back some of our salary. And since the Czechoslovak government had some economic issues or major economic problems, this worked out quite well for them as well. So we lived in Kuwait for a few years and experienced a totally different world at that time.
Were you ever, and of course this, you're experiencing back home in Czechoslovakia shortages of just about everything through the 1970s, is that right?
Yes.
So what about at any point did your family or your father fall under suspicion from the government?
Yes, we did. In the 70s when we returned, I returned earlier because we were not allowed to go to any Western schools in Kuwait. There was a school, Czech school, through fifth grade. So in sixth grade, I went back home. My grandmother stayed with me. And then my parents returned a little bit later. And my father did come under suspicion, especially because he was not really well adapted to the system. His work was a little bit too free-spirited. And I think for everyone who returned back was under suspicion. That was not unusual.
The very fact that you'd been away, that you'd been collaborating with sometimes foreign scientists.
You can't avoid that, right? So then you immediately become suspicious.
I'm talking with Hanna Pihova today on The State of Things. She's a professor of Slavic studies at UNC Chapel Hill, and we are meeting her today talking about her travels from what was then Czechoslovakia to the United States, where she has been for 35 years. So at a certain point, your family is really seriously considering leaving Czechoslovakia. Talk about that conversation or the decision. It must have been very difficult for them.
Well, my parents talked about it ever since they were in America, since 1969. That was a repeating topic at our dinner table or after dinner. And so I was exposed to it since I was in second grade. And it was a forbidden topic, of course. Nobody could discuss this openly because you could end up in prison in Czechoslovakia. So immigration was illegal, of course. But it became more and more urgent. My parents did not really want to emigrate. They had their families there. They had security there. They didn't feel the need. They still believe things are going to change a little bit. But by the end of the 70s, it was just getting worse and worse. And politically, of course. And for them, it became a much more pertinent issue. So I think by 79, it was something that they really wanted to do.
So talk about the actual decision and how it all came about.
So it came about by chance, which we could not, of course, influence and had no say in it. But for a few years, probably since 76, we've been applying for visas to travel abroad. And you could do that. You could travel to Yugoslavia, you could travel even to West Germany. So you could apply for this visa, which was usually a 2-week-long visa. And then you got in your car, you crossed the border with all your documents, with I believe it was $200 per family and camping equipment because it was assumed you would be camping since you didn't have any money. and then you would return. Many people did not return. Many people actually, especially through Yugoslavia, emigrated. Or when they visited the West, they stayed in the West. So we had this discussion as well, and we were not getting these visas. You could be denied the visas. Not everybody got them, of course. So we were denied the visas, and in 1979, during the summer, we received them. And we received them on my 18th birthday, actually, which was very strange because at that point I was independent, and so I should have normally been applying separately from my family. But we received them, and then a month later we emigrated.
You went to, was it Switzerland at first?
We went to Switzerland first because we had friends there, and we thought that we would apply for visas from Switzerland to America and just move on to America. That was, of course, very foolish because Switzerland, as a neutral country, does not let you emigrate any further.
So you could have stayed there. But
so we could have stayed there, but we didn't have any intention of staying there.
We will talk about how you left Switzerland, where you went next, and how you came to the United States when my conversation with UNC professor Hanna Pikova continues on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio, today talking with UNC professor Hanna Pikova, who emigrated from Czechoslovakia 35 years ago, and we're hearing the story of that journey. I got you to Switzerland. I'm going to get you to the United States, but I want to know what it's like to be a second grader and beyond with that big secret. Did you ever tell where there were? Because there might have been other second graders who had a secret and pulled you over.
Well,
and say,
everybody
Hanna.
Had a secret, right? Everybody had a little secret in a totalitarian society. Everybody has a secret. But this was a big secret, and I knew deep down that it was too dangerous to discuss with anyone. And I did not have a friend that I could reveal it to when I was in second grade or third grade. I had a friend later on when I was 17 that I revealed it to. But not before that.
Had you seen the consequences? Had you had friends who had suffered the consequences of the government either finding out or they're having gone too far?
No, but you heard about it. Yeah. And the dissidents were very active at this time. And so any openness landed you in jail. So I was very careful. And I was brought up that way. So it was kind of a second nature to me.
So now you're 18 years old. You're in Switzerland with your family. You learn that they cannot help you transfer to the United States. What do you do next?
Well, this was a huge blow to my parents because they were expecting to stay with our friends. We were at their house. They felt that to go to Germany and immigrate through Germany was complicated now. And they kind of lost their guts. And for my father especially, I think he always looked for signs. And this was a sign that we should just return, that it did not work. Well, at this point, I was 18 and I was determined to leave. I've had plenty of these indecisions all my life. And I was also worried that I was going to live in this regime forever without any opportunities. And it was not a question of ambition. I was not really ambitious, but I really wanted to have freedom. I wanted to study. I wanted to pursue kind of my life. So the person who was a German, actually, whose house we were staying at, he somehow intuitively understood my thought processes, and we agreed very quickly that if he takes me to the German border first, he'll help me to cross it and apply for political asylum, and that, of course, my parents would follow once they hear that I've done this. So that's exactly what we did. We drove secretly to the border with this German friend who was at that time maybe in his 40s. And then he called back home, called my parents, and called his wife and said, we just crossed the border and she has applied for a political asylum. And so then my parents, of course, got into the car. And on that side of the, they were still in Switzerland. I was in Germany already. And they were asking, what have you done?
Well, it's quite a gamble. I mean, for you as an 18-year-old, maybe it was very clear in your eyes and in your mind what to do. But imagine, and I'm sure you've thought about it, your parents. Sure, they don't want to be separated from you, but what a gamble. You have to receive asylum. And if you don't, you're there without papers. And there's family back in Czechoslovakia as well. So mm-hmm. there you are in Germany, also family at risk, I would assume. Am I mm-hmm. right? Was
yes,
your family
yeah.
at risk? And this is all part of their thinking.
Yeah, but when you're 18, you have totally different thought processes. So you're willing to take a lot of risk,
yeah.
and you don't think things through, which is helpful at times.
Helpful at times. And your parents did follow.
And the parents, yeah, my parents, of course, followed, even though they were kind of shocked by it, but they did follow.
Received asylum. I'm going to fast forward. We're going to get some of the details along the way. But today, what do they think about that decision and how do they feel about it?
I think, well, we never discussed it after that. Mm-hmm. It was silently accepted. I think they feel quite at home in the U.S. They feel quite at home back at home in the Czech Republic now as well. But I think for them it was a good decision. It was a good decision for all of us.
So what did you do next?
In Germany? Or?
Yeah, in Germany.
So in Germany, I was lucky enough. Well, this was really wonderful that my father had so many good friends in the West. And we had some Canadian friends, a geologist from Montreal who paid for my high school, American high school. I went to an American high school in Germany, in Heidelberg, for a semester because we had to wait for visas to come to the United States. And when you're waiting for visas, you don't know when you're going to get them, and you can't work, you can't do anything but wait. Because the refugee camps were totally full, and that during that year, there was a huge influx of emigres from Poland, Czechoslovakia. They placed us in Heidelberg in a one-room apartment. It was a bit cramped, of course, but Heidelberg was a good city to end up in. And because the high school was there, the American high school, which had to be paid for, so the Canadian friend paid for my tuition there.
You were talking about this aspiration for freedom and more possibilities for yourself and your future. Did you have particulars in mind? Did you see what that future was going to be?
Well, I wanted to study literature. Beyond that, I didn't really know much, only from books. You know, I read Jack Kerouac. I thought On the Road was fabulous. I had no idea what it really meant. But, you know, in the mind of an 18-year-old from Czechoslovakia, it has a totally different meaning than to an American of that same age. The other book that I thought was important, of course, was, and I already, we discussed this, was Franz Kafka's Metamorphosis. And that was the other side of the coin, where I thought, when I read that book at the age of 16 or 17 in Prague, and it was a forbidden book, it was censored, I felt that in that system, in that totalitarian system, everybody is a bit like Gregor Samsa. So I didn't want to be like Gregor Samsa.
Trapped in this body where no one understands you and they can't quite hear you, and you're not particularly welcome in that system.
No, you're not welcome at all.
What other – were you reading a lot of forbidden literature? Did you become attracted to it and find it?
Yeah, I think most kids my age, or many kids my age educated families did read that. We shared it. But I didn't have a lot of access to it. But what I did, I was grateful for. And it had deep meaning for me.
There's no better way to get kids to read than forbid the books.
Yes,
absolutely. I'm all for banning books. I think more libraries and more counties should do it just so kids read.
If we ban all of the books, then I think we're going to have a great readership.
And I got a great list that they should ban because I want kids, every kid to read it.
Yeah.
Kafka's kind of interesting. I don't know. I want to go down this, take this little tangent for a moment because for a while the communists didn't know what to do with him, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, to some degree, he seemed to support a lot of Marxist ideals. Alienation was sort of inherent in his work, and the great bureaucratic system that he seemed to be satirizing was the thing they replaced, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and by golly, we replaced that, didn't we? They didn't know what to do with him at first, did they?
Yeah, but his books were republished in the 60s. There was even a Kafka conference in the early 60s, but later on, it was very difficult to get hold of his books. And when you read The Castle, when you're living in a totalitarian society, or The Trial, it's very heavy and depressing, and you see everything around you start appearing that way, whether you want it or not. And I couldn't read The Castle or The Trial because I didn't have a copy of those in Czechoslovakia during that time. I just read The Metamorphosis, but that was plenty enough for me.
Well, it's interesting. Early in the early years of communist rule, that's when Kafka seemed to be okay because, again, he was replacing a kind of bureaucracy that we were now going to, you know, sort of bring us into the new age. After it became clear that they had taken that bureaucracy and raised it to new levels and everyone couldn't read those books without thinking about the kind of nightmare of living in the totalitarian regime, that's when he became kind of an embarrassment. So now you've been to an American school. What was your sense of American students then? These are Americans abroad, I'm sure, children of diplomats, et cetera.
No, these were military kids.
Military kids.
So the kids were a little foreign to me. I wasn't quite sure what to make out of them. But the teachers were amazing at that school. Now, the teachers were thrilled to have me there. They were very helpful in every possible way because most of them lived in Germany for a long time. They were there during 1968. They remembered the Soviet invasion of Czechoslovakia, and they really helped me out tremendously to kind of navigate through the American education system. They helped me with my English. I mean, my English wasn't that great. And I think I got a really good base because of it. Now, the kids, I was puzzled. I didn't know what to think about them. But they were, you know, these were not typical American kids. They lived in Germany for a long time. And many of them have traveled. Every year they've been somewhere else. So they were some of them were extremely educated, knew many languages. But, you know, we didn't have a common ground, really.
Well, puzzled how?
Well, I didn't, you know, their background was so different. The American culture was so different to me. And they very much were steeped in that culture, even though they lived in Germany. So I didn't get it.
What did they make of you?
I think they were very friendly to me. I mean, in spite of everything, I think they tried.
So when you finally tell us about coming to the United States, when did that happen and where was your first stop?
So we came in 1980 and we came to New York and we flew from Germany on a special plane that was only for refugees, political refugees from Eastern Europe. And we landed in New York, and in New York, the moment we got off the plane, there was a man who asked everyone what their profession was, and then he distributed everyone according to what he thought should be their next stop. So to one family, this was an engineer, he said, I think you should go to Portland, and another, and Seattle. So the next flight is that way, and he provided tickets for them. For my dad, when he heard he was a geologist, he said, well, I think Houston would be a good place. But my dad said, no, we're not going to any Houston. We have friends in Wisconsin, Madison. We're going to go there. Now, Wisconsin, Madison is not the center of oil business, so...
No, but the beer is better and much closer to what you would have had at the Czech Republic, I think.
That is true.
Okay. Forgive me. It's your story. Go ahead.
So, but we had friends there. And so my dad felt that we had to situate ourselves, know where we were going to go and be with someone again, with some Czech people. And then from there, look for a job. So we did go to Madison, Wisconsin, got there, and I was able to finish high school there. And my dad actually did end up in Houston. A few months later, he got a job in Houston, Texas.
And what were you doing all this time?
Well, I was going to school, finishing up high school, mm-hmm. and then I actually decided to stay in Wisconsin and continue with my university studies in Madison.
And did you already know you would study literature?
Well, that was kind of a point of disagreement within my family because as an emigre, as a first-generation emigre, that's an incredible luxury, right? You are supposed to do something that you're going to survive on. Literature, we're looking at 1980s. In 1980, literature is not exactly the profession that your parents want you to take if they feel that you have to make it here. Mm-hmm. So, I got a Bachelor of Science, although I did, and I did a lot of calculus and chemistry, but eventually I ended up pursuing what I wanted and got a degree in comparative literature. Mm-hmm.
What about back home? Are you keeping in touch with family in Prague?
Yeah, we were able to do that, but every letter is opened, of course. There are some problems. My mother's brother lost his job after we emigrated. Excuse me. He was able to get his job back in the 90s, after 1989, But at that time, he was a pilot and worked for a TV station, and he was not considered safe anymore. So he got a job working in a restaurant in the mountains.
We are meeting Anna Pichova today on The State of Things, a professor of Slavic studies at UNC Chapel Hill, talking about the transition from what was then communist Czechoslovakia to the United States of America and ultimately to UNC Chapel Hill. Was this a concern? How your parents handling this? And were there other repercussions to other family members or friends?
There didn't seem to be any other repercussions because nobody else had jobs that were that important. And the grandparents were already old. I think the most traumatic event was when my grandparents died on my father's side because we could not go back. We could not go back for the funeral. That was not possible for us because in Germany already, after half a year after our emigration, we received a prison sentence for our illegal departure. And once you were given that return back, even on an American passport at that time, which we did have, did not seem very safe. Although some people did go back and visited family members, but we didn't feel very secure.
How about you making the adjustment here? You said at first Americans puzzled you a little bit, your peers, once you were in Wisconsin. How were things going? How did the adjustment go?
Well, they puzzled me even more. because they're even less European, right? So I was very much puzzled. I was puzzled by my professors, too. I did not know what languages they were speaking, although it was all English, but different dialects, of course. I was rather puzzled by TV, by the culture in general.
I heard that commercials really kind of freaked you out a little bit.
Yeah, commercials got to me. I didn't understand for the longest time how you can have news interrupted by commercials. That to me seemed so sacrilegious when there is a newsman and all of a sudden you cut it in half and then there is a stop. So, and I didn't get the commercials at all.
Did you know that you were sliding into a commercial? Could you tell that that's what was going on?
At first, I didn't even know what what was going on because I never saw a commercial before. And then all of a sudden you, because in a communist country, in a TV, you didn't have commercials, or I don't remember any, but I watched a minimal amount of TV all my life. So in America, when I did see this, I mean, then I figure out, okay, these are commercials, they're advertising, but why are they advertising for such stupid things? And so I really had a hard time with it until the commercial, you may remember this one, of Where's the Beef? Yeah. The lady with Where's the Beef? Yeah. Then I started looking at it differently. Then I thought, oh, there's some humor in this. And I just don't get the humor. Not every commercial has humor, of course, but many of them do. So then I started actually looking at it differently and pondering it a bit more.
And the gravity, that particular commercial made its way into American politics, famously.
Yes.
So you see, it is. And these days, by the way, they reversed it. Now the commercials are interrupted by news.
Yeah.
So they fixed that problem for you. I'm talking to UNC professor Hanna Pihova today on The State of Things. That conversation will continue when we return. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio, talking with UNC professor Hanna Pihova. We're talking about working your way to the United States. Eventually, you made your way to Texas, right?
Yeah. So I stayed in Madison, Wisconsin until I completed my degree. And then I was lucky enough to look for a job in 1990, just as the Berlin Wall fell down, and I was able to come on the market at a time when there was great interest in that region. Now, after getting a degree in comparative literature, a master's degree, I decided to move into Slavic, and I thought I would teach probably Russian. There was no Czech program that I could, and it didn't even occur to me to do Czech, but I thought I would get a job, hopefully one day, working as a comparativist with emphasis on Russian literature. And in 1990, when I went on the job market, there were tons of jobs because there was such a huge interest and so many students wanted to study Russian, Polish, Czech. And in Texas at that time, at that very moment, they opened up a position. They had a Czech chair position plus another position, which I applied for, which was a tenure track position. And I went there. So I started teaching at UT Austin in 1991.
I want to hear more about that, and particularly the interest of students in Slavic studies and literature in particular. But I have to ask you how you felt and what your family thought of this, what appeared to be a very sudden end to totalitarianism in that part of the world.
Well, the whole 1989 year was shocking to us. The Czechs were the last, but it was so surprising that the collapse took such a short period. And it ended with the Czechs and the news. I actually was on news back then. When the Czechs had their Velvet Revolution in Madison, the TV station got me to talk there a little bit, even though I knew nothing because I was just watching the news. I wasn't able to go there, which till this day I really regret. I wish I would have been there at that moment. I think I missed this amazing historical moment that happens once, if one is lucky, in their lifetime. So the transition happened so quickly that it was really hard to believe that it was actually happening. And we were able to go back in 1990 to visit. And it was such a different country. I didn't recognize anything. Just imagine all the names on the streets and on the metro were changing. I didn't know where I was. I couldn't remember things. And everybody was different, of course. So it was extremely confusing. It was so exciting because democracy there was so spirited and uplifting And so young, of course.
It's interesting to hear you say that when you there's obviously an interest in Slavic studies, particularly by 1990 in this country, given the events in Eastern Europe, but that you chose to speak Russian. There wasn't much Czech to speak of. I say that because for the first republic for the Czechs in the early part of the 20th century was led by a playwright, Thomas Masaryk, and I'm sure I'm saying his name wrong. And then Václav Havel becomes the playwright who leads the Czechs out of totalitarianism. Again, another playwright. So writers are at the heart of politics and culture in the Czech Republic.
Yeah, that's always been the case, that literature, Masaryk was primarily a philosopher, but they were always connected to politics. And till this very day, I think they have a large say in many things. So that's part of the culture there.
What do you teach now? And tell us about the students who take your classes now. What are they expecting and what are you teaching?
Well, let me return to the 90s. So in the 90s, because there was such a moment of change, many of the students in Texas back then actually wanted to go to that part of the country, to that part of the world. Many wanted to go to Czechoslovakia, to Prague, because it was cheap. It was very different. Or they wanted to go to Hungary or Poland. Some to Russia, of course. But so I had many of these students who were very dedicated to taking 1 year of Czech and then going there and experiencing what it is all about, and how transition and freedom actually works in its beginning form. So I had that whole generation of kids who were really quite well educated about, because they grew up in the 80s and they knew about the Cold War. But now, of course, times are different. These kids were born in the 90s that I teach, and they have never heard of the writers that were so common back in the early 90s or even 80s, and they don't know much about the Cold War. So I have to give a lot of historical background when I teach my literature class. We discuss politics. There's a lot of explaining, but there is great interest in it nonetheless.
Interest, when they come to you, there's some interest, or does it develop after they start taking class?
Well, some already have an interest in it because of their family background, or because they know someone from that part of the world, or because they traveled there and they're intrigued, or because they read a book about it. But most of them, that they look at the titles, of course, of classes. They see, okay, at 2 o'clock I'm free, I can take this class, and let's see what's offered. And they have Chaucer, and then they have Milan Kundera. And they think, well, Chaucer, Milan Kundera, I don't know anything about Milan Kundera, maybe this will be fine. And then, oh, and they read, of course, what these courses are about. And all of a sudden, they happen to be in my class and they realize, oh, this is very different and I have never had anything like this.
So apart from the politics, you say, you know, I have never heard of Milan Kundera. And of course, in the 1980s, everybody had. The Unbearable Lightness of Being was a very popular book. Mm-hmm. And that brought to light his other works before and since. I mean, is that true? Students don't know much about him. And then how do you teach a figure like Kundera to people who've never heard of him and who didn't know the Cold War?
Well, it requires the historical background. We have to discuss what happened in Czechoslovakia from 1918 until now. We have to dedicate a few hours to dates and to communism and to politics, basically. And then we read him in that context, because without that context, the little historical snippets that he has in his books don't make any sense to them. So I have a lot of students who come to the class and they tell me, I saw the movie Unbearable Lightness of Being, or I read the book. And then we read it again within the context of history and politics and Czech culture. And then they say, oh, I never got it when I read it the first time. So it does require that, I think, for this generation, a little bit more knowledge about the past.
Certainly, Havel and Kundera were very political, fiercely anti-totalitarian and anti-communist at periods in their lives, and clearly identified with that. But now when you read Kundera, and even Havel to some degree, there is also a strong critique or certainly a view and description of modernism. Does that make a difference now, sort of apart from the whole Cold War dyad, to look at what a figure like Kundera says about modern life, modernism?
I think for the students, it's important because when they read some of his novels that were written in the late 90s, they see that he's not just a writer that zooms in on totalitarianism, but he has a critical eye towards our society in general. His novel Slowness, which is a very short novelette, in that novel he talks about how we speed everything too much, how we don't have time to digest information. And I think this speaks to the students. They ponder it.
Because the slowness in that, I think he also treats memory, consciousness, and then kind of in some ways technology, the way modern life speeds things up and the way memory might slow things down. And it's a very thoughtful meditation on where we are, whatever your politics.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think they can take that and they can take any of his books and apply it to their daily life to some extent.
You also teach an essay that that I find near and dear to my heart that Václav Havel wrote in 1978 called Power of the Powerless. He was writing, and I think mostly for an Eastern European audience, though certainly it got picked up quickly in the West. Tell us a little bit about that period, 1978, when he wrote it, and some of the more nuanced ideas that he projected in that essay.
Well, in 1978, that was a bleak year. Economically, politically, the dissidents were very active. Some were in prison. And there was not a lot of hope. It was a very dark year. And when it's combined with a lot of economic hardships, it seems even worse than just even a few years before that. So it was a very serious winter in 78, 79. So we, for example, had 6 weeks off from school because of coal. There was not enough coal. And we of course liked it when we were 17. We didn't have to go to school. But if you're an adult and you see that the country is falling apart and there is absolutely nothing, you feel a lot of desperation. You start looking around and pondering the system probably even more so. But the essay, I think, speaks even to today's problems. When we read it in class, and I used to do this experiment in Texas, I had a classroom which had two doors. And before we read this essay, I would deliberately say, and the students would come in from both doors, from the right one and the left one. And one year I decided to do an experiment. And before we read this essay, I would say to them, okay, on Tuesday, make sure you come from the left door. And they all agreed to it. Nobody questioned it. And on Tuesday, they really did come from the left door. Not a single one deviated. And then I said, by then they read the essay, and I said, now you read the essay, you came from the left door, nobody asked me why should we come from the left door, what's wrong with the right door? You just obeyed me without any question. So I think then they really pondered it.
Because the essay really deals with some of that, and I think it was a great lesson to the West to realize that there aren't people standing with shotguns at every door forcing people into factories. He talks about the way we police ourselves in any system, and he's talking about a totalitarian system, and this essay fueled many of the dissidents who said they got great strength from reading this. So it certainly was help in maintaining that dissident movement in the communist world, but it stands as a warning to us as well, doesn't it? How complicit we are in lining up ourselves to be advertised to and buy whatever product it is in the name of freedom. I mean, it does strike me as a warning. And he even says that. He says, to some extent, this is a kind of warning to the West, although I'm writing it to you.
Absolutely. And I think that's what the Czech literature in general has in common. There's always some type of question, and it's not answered. You don't get answers. It's in Czech film as well. You have a lot of questions. And in the culture, of course, in general. So I think the students like that. They start thinking about things a little bit differently.
How has teaching all of this changed or helped you sort of understand your own history? Has it?
I think so. I think on one hand, I appreciate the students' total trust, you know, that they don't question me. And that I always tell them, why do you think that I wouldn't lie or that I wouldn't make something up? You know, I'm a storyteller. I love to create stories. So you should always question me as well. So on one hand, I think, especially when I have a very good class, I tell them a little bit from my life, not too much, but a little bit. And it kind of I grow with them, I think.
Well, Hannah, your story's out now, and we're assuming that most of it is true.
Well, you question that.
I did. I for an hour, and yeah. I'm assuming everything you said is true. And what a great pleasure talking with you,
well,
Hannah.
Thank you.
Hannah Pikova is a professor of Slavic studies at UNC Chapel Hill and also an author. And you can find out more about her at our website, stateofthings.org. We've got lots of information there, as well as any of the events and listings that we talk about on this program. State of Things is a program produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadi Mwagdi, and Will Michaels. Robin Copley is our technical director. Al Wadarski is sitting in today. Brent Wolf is our news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to preview a documentary that takes a look at a Woodhouse divided. The Woodhouse brothers, Brad, led communications for the Democratic Party. His brother, Dallas, well, he started their help to start the Koch-funded Americans for Prosperity. At one point, they lived under one roof. And there is a documentary film that talks about these two brothers in North Carolina. We'll preview that and more tomorrow on The State of Things. Please join us. I'm Frank Stachow.